We continue with our series on Muslim communities. Joining me on the line from Port Elizabeth, Mawlana Yusuf bin Mahat. Mawlana, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Mufti Sam.
How are you this evening?
Alhamdulillah, very, very well.
Alhamdulillah, that's good to hear. Mawlana, we continue with our discussion with regards to Uzbekistan.
That's correct, Mufti Sam. Yes, inshallah ta'ala, this evening we did begin discussing the history of this intriguing and very distant country of Uzbekistan a week or two ago. And inshallah ta'ala, this evening, we will continue with the history of this country and then move on to other aspects of the country, inshallah, later on. We spoke in the past about the Persians who had settled in the area, and then the arrival of the Sahaba, Sa'id bin Uthman and Qasim ibn Abbas radiallahu ta'ala anhuma, and thereafter Qutaybah bin Muslim rahimahullah, who had come as a governor and had spread Islam in the region, and that led to the population accepting Islam. And then with the Seljuks and the subsequent Turkish tribes moving south into the Central Asia, we discussed the Turkification of the previously Persian region, and we ended up in the late 1100s. And now with the arrival in 1219, the entire region is overturned, and the shock and awe tactics of Genghis Khan places the entire region in turmoil. And that's where we will, inshallah, continue from this evening. So the Mongol invasion of Central Asia is one of the turning points in the history of the region. The Mongols had their conquest over Central Asia began in 1219 and it continued right to 1225. And that led to a wholesale change in the population of Ma Warahu al-Nahr. And we spoke about the Turkification. This increased, even quickened the process, because a number of the people that made up the army of Genghis Khan were some of the tribes which he had conquered, and many of them were Turkic tribes. And they had intermixed with the local populations, and that now brings about a totally different population in Central Asia. We do know the history and the Mongols and what they left in their wake in Central Asia. In Bukhara, Samarkand, Khwarizm, they had ransacked the cities and decimated the populations. These were very wealthy states, and they were left totally in ruins. Following the death of Genghis Khan in 1227, his empire was divided among his four sons and his family members, because they believed that the only legitimate ruler of Central Asia could be a descendant of Genghis and nobody else. And they managed to keep hold on the areas which were conquered, not everything, but a large percentage of it, and they maintained orderly succession for several more generations, particularly in the hands of Chagatai, who was one of the sons of Genghis, the second son of Genghis Khan. And thereafter, a number of other rulers ruled in his name. And we do know later on in the history, which we did discuss a long time ago when we discussed Islam in Mongolia, we discussed how the descendants of Genghis had actually accepted Islam. So moving through the centuries, the descendants of Genghis are still ruling Central Asia. And in the early 14th century, the empire begins to break up into its constituent parts, and various tribal groups vie for dominance of the region. And one particular tribal chieftain, his name in English is Taymalan, and whose name is Persian name is Taymur Lung. He has a penetrating impact on the history going forward of this region. He was a Turco-Mongol as well. He emerged from the struggles as the dominant force in the year 1380 in Ma Warahu al-Nahr. And although he was not a direct descendant of Genghis, some records I did come across, he was actually from his mother's side, he was linked to Genghis Khan. Allahu alam, we don't really know exactly. It could be very well be like how some of the Gujarati people like to make hagas everywhere. It could be one of those possible incidents. In any case, he is now taken over the Central Asian region, and he becomes the de facto ruler of Ma Warahu al-Nahr. And he begins and proceeds to conquer the entire western Central Asia, Iran as well, Asia Minor, and even the southern steppe region of the Aral Sea. He even invaded Russia later on, and very much towards which ended his life was when he tried to invade China as well. So he emerges now as the most powerful ruler, and he was a Muslim, and he emerged as the most powerful ruler in the Muslim world. He defeated the Mamluks of Egypt and Syria. In 1393, he captured Baghdad. The emerging Ottoman Empire, Sultan Bayezid I, he captures him as well gets him and delivers a very humiliating defeat upon him. The declining Delhi Sultanate, he conquers them as well. And he now founds the Timurid Empire, which is now ruling the majority of the regions which we just mentioned. He was, as we say, a non-Chinggis, meaning not from the lineage of Chinggis, but he tried to build a double legitimacy based on his role as both a guardian and the steward of the Mongol Empire, as well as a Muslim hero for Muslims. So on the one hand, he's a rabbi of Islam, and by doing this, he justifies his attacks upon the Iranians, the Mamluks, the Ottomans as well. And he does this because now he is a Ghazi, and he is now trying to restore the Mongol Empire in the line of Chinggis. And on the other hand, he also converts a number of people to Islam. The Borjigin leaders, he invites them and converts them all to Islam. He also decisively defeats the Christian knights at Smyrna. So he is a double... He has this double figure which he plays throughout his life, and his armies were inclusively multi-ethnic from the different regions which he has conquered. They were very well; they were very much feared amongst his opponents and his enemies. And Allahu Alam, it is said that he actually people estimate that his military campaigns caused the deaths of 17 million people, which amounts at the time to 5% of the world's population of the time. So, according to many, he is hailed as a hero and a champion of Islam in some rights, but I personally have some mixed feelings, especially since he attacked the Khilafah of the Muslims and the Mamluks as well. But he is nonetheless, in Samarkand, if a person visits the city, he is the hero of Samarkand and the hero of Uzbekistan as well. So this is Taimur Lung, and he is now in the 1300s. And back home, besides his military campaigns, he initiated the last flowering of the Mawarahun Nahar region. He gathered in his capital, Samarkand, numerous artisans and scholars from the lands which he conquered. And by supporting such people, he imbued his empire with a very rich Persian-Islamic culture. A number of the buildings and madrasas and masajid which we saw were the remnants of his reign in the region. He's also recognized as a great patron of the art and of art and architecture. He interacted with many Muslim intellectuals like Ibn Khaldun and many others as well. And he also patronized the scientists and artists. His grandson, Ulugh Beg, who we will discuss inshallah hopefully next week, was one of the world's first greatest astronomers. And he was a ruler himself, and he ruled Central Asia from 1411 to 1449. And his great-great-great-grandfather, he is the great-great-grandfather of Babur, who is the founder of the Mughal Empire. So Taimur Lung now brings about a new dynasty, and people who are now going to rule Central Asia, and even his descendants are going to rule India and Pakistan and those areas later on. He dies in the year 1405 during an invasion in China. In this region, again, coming back to the history of the region, after Taimur Lung and his descendants, the Safavid Shias, they begin and they take rule of the entire Central Asia from the year 1501 to 722. And they are the ones who give the Ithna Ashariya Shiism some type of prominence in the international arena for the first time, really, in their history. The Uzbeks, they are a Turkish tribe, and they complete their conquest of Central Asia later on particularly in what is now the present-day Uzbekistan. So the Khanates of Bukhara and Tashkent, the Fergana Valley, all of these are under their rule. There's another Khanate, another Khan, another ruler of in a place, Kiva, which is very close, which is in present-day Uzbekistan as well. So you have these two Khanates, and they start fighting one another, and because of the endless wars amongst themselves, they begin to weaken later on in the 16th century. And another factor leading to the weakness is that the general decline of trade moving through the region. In the 16th century, we did discuss as, in the past, the Portuguese had found the way around the southern tip of Africa, and now the entire Silk Route becomes obsolete. Nobody really needs it. The trade route goes around through the ocean, and they are not needed anymore. And this now begins, the decline of the region now begins. Moving on, in the Russians are obviously north of Central Asia, and the people in Central Asia, they have continuous invasions from the Shia, from the Safavids, and in the south, and from Iran, and from the north as well. And in this period now, in the 1700s, a new group of people, the Russians, they begin to appear on the Central Asian scene. They are drawn there to expand their trade relations with the people in this region. There were also a large number of Russian slaves who were sold in the markets of Central Asia, and obviously they weren't too happy about that. So now they are drawn more towards this region. In the late 18th and early 19th centuries, there are a number of new dynasties who begin ruling in these areas. You have the Kongrats, you have the Mangrits and Mings, and all of these people are now ruling autonomously in their own name without Russian influence, having trade relations with the Russians. But with the ascendance of Russian power in the Kazakh steppes, and as well as the establishment of the British position in Afghanistan, now these people are caught in between these two very powerful Caucasian or European competitors, and people who study history would be able to tell you that this was known as the great game where between the British and the Russians they were vying for different regions for conquest, and they were vying with one another to capture different regions. The Central Asians, they didn't realize what danger they were in, and they were still busy wasting their strength in wars amongst themselves. And the Russians slowly begin to take over the region. Initially, at the beginning of the Russian aggression, they start taking over, and the policy of converting Muslims forcefully to Christianity was followed. So this is now before communism. And this began, and thereafter this was left... this policy was abandoned, and between the period of 1738 and 1755, also a number of masajid were closed, were locked up. This is now before communism, and the Russians were still very Christian. And preaching Islam at the time was declared as a crime and was liable to the death penalty. Later on in the 19th century, the Russians, their interest in the area has increased greatly, sparked by the nominal concern over the British designs on Central Asia and also the desire to control the trade in the entire region. It is a region which is very rich in cotton, and Russia was seeking this, and thereafter they expanded and they begin taking over the region. By the year 1876, the entire territory, including present-day Uzbekistan, has either fallen under direct Russian rule or has become a protectorate of Russia. And initially, for the people that are living there, their daily lives don't change greatly. The Russians don't meddle with the internal affairs. But as time goes on, the Russians start bringing in more of their own people into the regions. They initially had parallel cities where the Russians would stay and not mix with the locals. But with the introduction of train lines, many and in large numbers, Russians began settling in Central Asia in the year 1890, and thereafter they now start meddling with the affairs of the people. and they cracked down upon the Central Asian Muslim population, and Islam is basically outlawed. The only avenue for the Uzbeks to now resist this Russian rule, it came in the form of a pan-Turkish movement. It was known as Jadidism, which is, Allahu A'lam, it has, different people have different views regarding it. Some say it's sought to revive Islam and to give the people their own autonomy. I could now be wrong, but it seems to me it is more of a, it is more politically motivated and more revolutionary, very much like the pan-Turkic state or the pan-Arab state which Gamal Abdel Nasser wanted to establish, or like the Young Turks in Turkey, which we discussed, more along those lines. So they are now bringing up a resistance against the Russian rule. The Khanates, by the year 1900, as we said, they had a little bit of autonomy, but they were under Russian rule, and the Russians were now completely in control over the entire region. And these Jadidists, they now try their best to reform and to modernize Islam to fit into the new modern era, according to them, and they try now to use this to resist the Russian control over them. They tried very hard, but over the next few decades they were ultimately crushed, and the leaders thereafter found their home in communism. So obviously they were not very firm on Islam. The objective was more to take control and more politically motivated. And now they found their home in communism, and they led the population to believe that their autonomy lay in them following communism. So a number, or the majority of the people, began following them and listening to them and actually voting for them. Some of the communist reformers who actually did the groundwork for Joseph Stalin's movement, they did all of this groundwork for him, and they were given much prominence and high positions, but later on they were arrested and even executed thereafter. So this is what happens after him. A number of more and more people begin voting or following and joining the Communist Party of Uzbekistan, which becomes the ultimate opposition to the Russian rule. And what happens in 1991, they are given a sort of independence where Islam Karimov is chosen as the nation's first president. He actually died, I think it was last month. So he was in 1991 chosen as the nation's first president. It was actually a very clever ploy by him. One day when you have some time, inshallah, we can discuss that. But he became the nation's first president, and he began adapting the situation to get the votes of the people in his favor. So he brings about some Islamic symbols, he goes for Hajj, but he ultimately cracks down upon Islam and upon any dissent in the country. And over the last two decades, there have been a number of terrorist attacks against the government. From the government side, according to the British ambassador, Craig Murray, and this is in 2004, he was removed from his post because he spoke out against the regime's human rights abuses. And there's been a number of different problems which arose in the country. The government has held a tight fist over the people. There's been imprisonment of a number of people. But that is the story of Uzbekistan very much until today. And inshallah, we can end off here. And next week, inshallah, even though we would like to discuss modern-day Uzbekistan, I think it's only necessary for this country particularly that we discuss the very important people who have come from this area, because there are a large number of them, and we can, inshallah, learn from them, inshallah.
Well, very interesting, and we look forward to that, Mawla. This evening's session has been captivating. The information that you've shared with us is really, really fascinating. Allah reward you abundantly, and we look forward to the subsequent session, inshallah.
Jazakallah khairan to you, Muqtab, once again.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
That was Mawlana Yusuf Behmat with the weekly segment focusing on Muslim communities, and Mawlana then outlining to us that the issue with regards to Uzbekistan and the link to South Africa We'll talk more about that, inshallah. That's where we leave it for this evening and for this week. Till next week, Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum.